Mel, who do we have today on our show? I believe we've got some people from NATCA.
Yes, we've got our push-to-talk segment in the morning here with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. We've got Grant Anderson from our Springfield Approach Control, and you also do the tower. Yes,
that's true.
Yes, and Chris, is it Karanoff?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Chris Karanoff with Miami Center.
Right.
So we've got a nice little mix here. And Anna, you're in the training right now.
Yes,
at Purdue. So welcome, guys.
Excellent. Thanks. Excellent. Tell me, what's the difference between tower and center in terms of operationally as a controller? I mean, do you have to go into it every day with a slightly different mentality if you're working tower versus working center?
Different view.
Want me to take a shot at that?
Go ahead.
I've worked both, but on the tower side, everything is compressed. You're normally dealing with anywhere from 30 to 60 miles out from the airport, and you're using a radar which has a faster sweep. It doesn't have as much of a range, but you can actually, for that type of operation where you're bringing the aircraft in close and reducing speed and setting up your sequencing and finals, you get that sort of a characteristic on the TRACON side. And then, of course, in the tower, dealing with the runways and the immediate airspace around that. On the center side, you're dealing with much larger areas of airspace, generally speaking, although they still work with to the ground with some airports that don't have approach controls. Generally speaking, everybody is in the latter stages of their climb, on early stages of their descent, or en route. And why don't you take it from there, Chris, as far as filling it in?
The scope generally is, like, for instance, my airspace, we work from pretty much a little bit south of Daytona and all the way down to below Palm Beach. So that's the synopsis of all the airspace that I work. So the scope range is more of like 100, 150 miles, where approach control is a lot closer, a lot, more compact. So.
Well, and I imagine down in Miami, you deal with it, Miami Center, as opposed to, a center in the middle of the country. You got a lot more international traffic coming on.
That and, like, my area is in Miami Center. One of the sectors there is the only sector in the house that actually runs an approach control, too. So we run approach control for Vero Beach and Fort Pierce, and you get a lot of traffic coming in from the Caribbean, obviously, a lot of language barriers sometimes, and Vero Beach, and then student pilots coming down from Daytona Beach, out of Embry-Riddle. You get a lot of foreign pilots. So that language barrier sometimes poses a threat on the frequency, sometimes some congestion, but it's you learn to deal with it,
Yeah, but you guys are brilliant with weather, because you're known throughout the U.S. for being able to shuffle and juggle and move people around, and you're very quick to tell people, if you go a little this way, a little that way, because in South Florida in the summer, that's the only way you can still fly airplanes.
Yeah, it's a well-known fact that, I'd rather work 25 planes in perfect weather than 4 airplanes with a whole bunch of weather around, just because you never know what planes need to do and where they need to go. But FAA is pushing a lot of weather scenarios and trying to up the safety and make sure that we're well-rounded as far as what we need to do with calling weather and making sure that all the airplanes are safe up there. So.
Well, I imagine PI reps become pretty crucial in those
Sigmas
circumstances.
And definitely.
Well, what I was going to say is, how does it work when you're dealing with more and more aircraft that have weather on board? And so they say, well, no, I'd really rather go this way. I see it this way.
We have NEXRAD that we deal with, and so that's just depicts precipitation. So what they're looking out the window, and if they have more advanced stuff on board, we still are required to call what we see in the most extent that we see it. But if they want to go one way and we're telling them this is what I'm showing out there, then that's eventually their choice. So, but
ultimately speaking, unless there's a conflict with another aircraft or airspace or terrain, the pilot in command is just that, the pilot in command. And he can, we can offer suggestions to them, and if they take it, great. If they don't, that's their choice.
What I've discovered with the NEXRAD on board is there's a latency factor. And often what it's showing me and what I'm looking at are not really exactly the same. There's a time lag from the time that that sweep went through, it hit the satellite, it hit the ground station, it hit me. And sometimes I'd much rather go with my eyes than what the machine's telling me. I've never had it horribly off except once when the wind was blowing 50 knots and nothing was where it was supposed to be on the screen. Makes a difference.
Oh, definitely.
That's sort of taking a picture of the race 20 seconds earlier. It's not where it's supposed to be. I guess there's always, and it exists on the controller side and the pilot side, I would assume that there's always a tendency for technology dependency that can get out of control. And sometimes you don't trust your eyes and your instincts. It's right there in front of you, and it could become complacent with it.
I think there's that dependency is sort of filtrating through the entire, you know, aviation. We got to really work on having some backup and some cognitive stuff that we can do rather than just what our machines and our displays are telling us.
Try to remember the display is a representation of what the computer thinks with all the information the computer has.
And it's a tool.
It's a tool. It is not reality.
That's right.
Yeah.
The reason for air traffic control. I stress that. I don't ever think that, you know,
a computer
can do what we do on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just there's way too much and way too many factors that are drawn in that humans need to make obvious decisions on that
right.
Computers really can't do. You know.
So Anna, you've got a future, a job in this.
Yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah. So you're learning a lot from...
I've had a great experience with NACA. They've really taught me a lot and showed me a lot of cool things that haven't scared me away yet, so...
And how does the CTI training program prepare you for some of the stuff these guys are talking about?
I feel pretty well prepared for Purdue, but a lot of it is just something that you have to learn on the job. And it... I'm looking forward to being able to have that opportunity to actually get into the workforce because I've been able to plug in a few centers and for a few hours and kind of just see what life as an air traffic controller would be like. And I think that was the most beneficial thing that I could see is actually watching and plugging in with an air traffic controller.
Do they put you into simulation programs? Do you have a big air traffic control simulator on campus?
At Purdue, we only have a TRACON simulator, so
okay.
I've never been into a tower one, which I'd really be interested in, you know, doing. But I've only had the TRACON background there.
Yeah, the tower one that I got to look at down at Pan Am International Academy in Miami is pretty impressive. What
yeah.
they can do with that.
Yeah, a couple of them. Embry-Riddle's got a pretty cool one now. I've seen that one up and running. It was in the early stages when I was there back in 2004, and they had just gotten it. But I've been back, you know, just talking on behalf of NATCA up to Embry-Riddle, and it's leaps and bounds where it's come from. So it's good to see because, you know, all these, you know, students that are coming through, they need as good of some type of representation of what we do as you can, because obviously this is a job that it's 100% of the time. You can't mess up. So,
well, there's a big push to scenario-based training overall in the aviation industry as opposed to just procedural.
Right.
You know, and have you noticed a change in the preparedness since this 2004 implementation?
Well, Grant's seen a lot more than I have over the years. So,
I suppose the easiest answer is it's a mixed bag. With some, yes. With others, no. Just like with anything else in technology, there's a definite use for these scenarios and simulations to better round out the early preparation for somebody as far as working as air traffic controller. Ultimately, it's the on-the-job training that finishes it off and gets everybody up to speed. But if you can take that both as a way of getting somebody a little further up to speed to start with, and also sort of as a screening process of are you cognitively getting this, what needs to be done. There's definitely use for simulation there, and it's cheaper, and it's because it's expensive to have somebody training live on the job with somebody else actually sitting there being paid to train them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the other possibilities of
things
going wrong.
They like to say that, you know, the training portion is, you know, just giving your bag of tools and learning from the bag of tools. And an air traffic controller will tell you, you know, you learn more after you're checked out than you will, you know, when you're in training. So
absolutely. Well, where can people find you on the field if they want more information about this?
We're right, what's the building
420,
number?
160,
I think. He turns around and points.
Yeah. But you've got the runway leading right into your tent, right?
It's a pretty ingenious little thing.
1836 is a stall runway.
Excellent.
And on the web also, if people are listening and they're not on the field?
That'll be at NACA, NATCA.org.
Excellent. Well, we're going to go to a break here, and we'll be right back.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Appreciate you having us.
Thank you.